Ladies and gentlemen, give him a warm welcome, Laurent Bourguignon.
I love the way you're so deliberate, how you like your cigarette, head on one side, as you pull, you look almost weak.
Hello, welcome. I'm very pleased to be here to talk to you about my job, which is being an integrator. My name is Laurent Bourguignon. I'm Senior User Experience Integrator for Identity Mine. We are a small firm specialized in user experience based in Seattle in Washington, and I'm working from Zurich in Switzerland. If you want more information about my day-to-day work, also find the source code that I'm going to show and more information about the tools, you can go to my blog. It's galasov.ch. And the first question that we can ask ourselves is, why did we come with a new role? So the integrator role comes from the fact that graphic designers very often work in tools that they know and like. And basically, it's, you know, let's face it, Adobe products. So here we have Photoshop, that's Photoshop CS4. But you find some designers who prefer, you know, Fireworks or Illustrator, depending on what they do. Now, in time, we found out that moving them to other products is actually very difficult. And, you know, if somebody has a tool that they like, they should be allowed to use them. On the other end of the spectrum, you have what we know and love as developers. I don't know if there are many designers in the room. Usually, I have like one hand or two hands. Anybody? Shout. Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. So mostly we are developers in the room, okay? So we know Visual Studio, that's probably the best development environment available right now. And, you know, we love it, but it's no good for design. And in between there is a big disconnect, or at least there used to be a big disconnect. So now this is exactly the place that Expression Blend is filling, okay? Expression Blend is a tool which allows you to go from one world, from the designer world, into the code, into the developer's world. And Expression Blend, even though it was actually at first, you know, sold as a design tool, personally I prefer to call that a visual development environment because it's actually running code. It's loading code, it's executing code, and you can actually build and run your application from Expression Blend. Okay? Now, since we have the role for the designer, we have a role for the developer, and you know, Blend was a little bit in between, and at Identity Mine, already quite some time ago, we found out that having a specific role for that person, for that tool, is actually beneficial. This way, you free the designer of having to learn a new tool, and you free the developers, who sometimes don't really have a design mindset, from having to work in a new, scary and dark tool. Because Blend is dark, okay? So anyway, so when I talk about the integrator role, first of all, you have to understand I'm talking about a role here. So it's not 100% of a job, okay? Typically, in most of the cases, the integrator is actually a developer who has a keen eye for design, who likes doing design. Maybe he's a guy who does web design on the side, like for his own website or whatever. And those people are a bit frustrated to work in code only, so those guys are really perfect for Blend, okay? But we also see designers who like to write code. Like my own boss, for example, he's a designer, he has been for years, and he's an integrator, he's able to actually write code and debug it, you know, so that's cool. So to me, an integrator is really a communicator and a translator. So you sit between two worlds, and then you have to translate from one side to the other. Okay, you translate from designer-ish, which is a language, to developer-ish, which is a totally different language. And those guys mostly don't understand each other so well. So you are here to help with the transition. Also, often the integrators are coach and trainers, and they should be, because, you know, when you have a big team of designers and an even bigger team of developers, and then you have like one or two persons doing the integration, it's really a bottleneck in your project. So if you get an integrator who is a coach and a trainer, he's able to pass this feeling for design, this knowledge, this, you know, Expression Blend expertise to the rest of the team. And eventually, the goal should be that this role is going to dissolve in the project. Okay? Like this, the poor guy can go on holiday and the project doesn't stop for 3 weeks. So what is a good integrator and what can he do? Well, user experience is super important because this is what you work with. Okay, that's what you create. Your deliverable is XAML. Okay, as an integrator, we actually own the XAML. So the designers create comps, developer creates, you know, C# code, and the XAML is your ownership. All right? So you have to understand user experience. And sometimes we talk about the designer as being about the integrator as being a production designer. So it's actually a design, very much design-oriented profession. Okay? At the same time, you have to know Expression Blend well. And when I say well, it's really the main tool that we are using. Okay? We will see a little bit later what happens when you cannot use Blend, and this is kind of painful. We need to understand the designer tools, such as, you know, Photoshop, Fireworks, Illustrator, etc., but understand them as users, so not necessarily being able to create stuff into that. Okay, I'm not able to do things in Photoshop, personally, but I'm able to find my way into layers, to hide and show some layers if needed, and to isolate pieces of the design that I want to export. And finally, you should know WPF and Silverlight very well. That's almost a requirement. The main reason is that the integrator is, or at least should be, involved quite early in the creation process. Okay? He's the person who is going to advise the developers on what controls they should choose to fulfill a given functionality. Now, in Silverlight and WPF, it's even more important because since you can style and template a control, you can change the look and feel of the control, but also the functionality of the control very much without having to resort to third-party controls. Okay? So as a matter of fact, in Silverlight and WPF, we actually buy less third-party controls than we used to do in other technologies, mostly because we can change the template. So an example that I have in mind when I talk about that, this is actually a Microsoft Surface application, which is here running in the simulator, and this is a well-known scatter view. Okay, the name of the control presenting those pictures is named scatter view. So what it does, the functionality it does, is present a list of items. And that's about it. Now the rest, you know, the fact that the items can be rotated, can be, you know, pushed over the screen, that's a problem of the template of the control. The list control that we have here is actually only presenting them. And interestingly enough, you have a whole lot of controls who do that. There are, you know, functionalities to present a list of items. We can think of list box, list view, data grid, tab controls. Okay, a tab control is just presenting a series of tabs. And they actually all, they are, you know, very much all the same control, which is called items control. Most of them are derived, you have maybe additional functionality, etc. And then by changing the template, you can take a list box and make it look like pretty anything you want. Okay? I don't know if you already saw those three-dimensional carousels in WPF where you can rotate around an axis. That's pretty much a list box with a different template. All right? So because of that, you know, you have to understand the WPF and Silverlight infrastructure. You have to know what controls are available. And most importantly, can I modify the template in a way that I can fulfill that? So this picture is actually not from me. It's my good friend Robin Gebretzen who did that. And it's kind of a view of all the type of designers that you can have on a project. And I just wanted to show that the production designer is also included there. So I felt very flattered the first time that I knew that I was actually a designer. Well, I'm not, you know, let's face it. But anyway, we work very closely with those guys. So I just want to say a few words about blendability, and then I'm going to show you a demo. Blendability is the ability to be edited in Expression Blend. All right, that's a new word. And also the Visual Studio Designer, because both of them are very close from each other in terms of architecture. So usually what you do in Expression Blend, if it works in Blend, it's going to work in the Visual Studio Designer as well. There are differences, but mostly it's not too bad. So how do we achieve blendability? Because don't forget, my goal as an integrator is to do as much as I can into Blend. But you need certain preconditions. So one precondition is you have to be able to switch the context between runtime and design time. You have to be able in your application to, you know, load a design time data context for your app and to have a runtime data context. Now, tomorrow I'm giving another talk here in the morning called Understanding the MVVM Pattern. And I'm going to go even deeper into that. So if you have time, I encourage you either to attend the session. That's, you know, self-promotion. If you don't have time, at least catch the video because I'm going to go a lot further. And I didn't want to have too much overlap. So let's go into that a little bit more superficially for now. So differentiating code and design, runtime and design, I'm going to show you one way to do that now and tomorrow more. Another thing which is important when you work into Blend is to be able to create design time data. So why do we need them? Basically because very often when you work into Blend, you are not able to connect, even though code is running in Blend, you are not able to connect to your data source. If it's a database, it will fail because the data context in which Blend is running is different from the Windows application. If it's connectivity to a WCF service or to a web service, it's probably going to fail as well because, you know, Blend tries to connect and then mostly doesn't work well. All right? So also another thing which we shouldn't forget is that often the services do not exist when you actually work on your application. And that's a case I encountered very often. The service layer is developed at the same time as the client, and you cannot connect to something that doesn't exist, all right? So Blend gives you the ability to create design time data and to simulate so that the designer, or the integrator in that case, has something to see and can design. So let's see a demo. So tomorrow I'm going to show, as I said, more about blendability, and I'm going to go into code. And I thought, okay, what can I do today, which is not, you know, overlapping too much because I don't want to bore everybody. So I thought, let's do a phone application. So I'm going to create a new project, take Windows Phone, and just create a normal phone application. So that's a Windows Phone 7. You have to install tools to get that into Blend. But basically, it looks like that. And first thing I want to do, I'm going to create a little bit of code behind. Here we go. And this will be very simple, but you will also already see that Blend has issues with that. So I'm creating here a dependency property. And this dependency property, can you read, or should I bump the size? Who wants me to bump the size? Nobody. OK. So anyway, this dependency property is going to hold some text. And this is a poem file that I'm actually loading from internet, from my website. So for now, this dependency property doesn't do anything. It's just sitting there. And I will go in my constructor. And this is really super simple. I'm just initializing a web client, and I'm going to download this URI from my website. Unfortunately, well, you know, first of all, let's do a little bit example. So what I want to do now is add a scroll viewer. Here we go. And then I'm going to add a text block. And now I'm going to do a data binding. First, let me build the application so that all my properties are available. I'm going to do a data binding. Now, Blend 4 has a cool feature, which is called element property binding down there. So it's just a shortcut, basically. It allows you to data bind very easily. So I can here take that, and I'm going to say I'm going to bind to the phone application page to the poem text dependency property that I set up just before. Let's say OK. Now we see immediately that in Blend, nothing happens. Okay, this application is not blendable. If I do run my application in the emulator, it's actually going to connect, and it loads the text file. Okay. So how do I do to make that blendable? Okay, the problem is that the web client is trying to connect and there is a timeout after a while. So one thing I can do is create here into Expression Blend a sample data source which is going to be used at design time. So I go here, choose a new sample data, and by the way, there are multiple ways you can do that in Blend 4. For example, you can import from XML, you can even create from a class. So if you have a class that is your data source, you can let Blend go and inspect this class and create design time data for you. Okay? Another way to do that would be to do what I'm going to show tomorrow, which is creating a different layer called the view model layer, but more about that tomorrow. So I'm going to here create a new sample data, and I'm going to say to Blend, you have to use this data only at design time by removing this checkbox. Now this sample data is going to be a little bit special because it has only one property, which I'm going to name exactly the same as my dependency property. And if I go and edit the data, I actually want only one row of data. And I'm going to say, make me 100 words taken from lorem ipsum. You can specify a lot of formats like address, colors, company name, date, etc., etc. All right. So now what I'm going to do is take this property, drag it on my text block, which is going to bind the content of this property to my text block. And now I can see that I have design time data showing up in Blend. So it's cool because I can design, but if I run, remember that's the design time data that I have here. So nothing will happen because I overwrote my initial binding on my text block. Okay? Now if you go and see the XAML, we see that the text property here is bound to my collection, which is not what I want. So how can we solve that? Well, what we need to do is differentiate the runtime context from the design time context. And fortunately, Blend can do that. Let me show you how. Instead of taking the poem text, which is a property, I'm going to take the collection, which is actually the object. And then I'm dragging it on my layout route. So let's inspect the XAML. What it did is create this property, which is called data context, but there is a D colon in front. Now, by saying that, you tell Blend to ignore this property. You tell actually Silverlight or WPF, it works the same, to actually ignore this property when it is running the application. Okay? This is a design time data context. There are a couple of properties, a little bit more than a couple, who work in design time. Like, for example, you might have seen already design width and design height, which is a way to set width and height for your UI when you are designing in Blend. And then the rest of the time is just scaling automatically. Data context is a very useful one. Okay? So, now that my data context is set on my grid, I can take the text block, and I'm going to change the data binding. You see that the data context here is set on my collection because I'm in design mode, and I'm going to choose a poem text property. So now I have my design time experience. Now the last thing I need to do is to create the runtime experience. So what I'm going to do is go to the layout route. I'm going to select the data context property, but this time I'm talking about the runtime data context. And I'm going to set this data context to my phone application page, which is the object on which the property is defined. Okay? Design time collection, which is sample data, runtime, the page with the actual property. Let's say OK. So now I can just do a little bit of design. But here I can see what I'm doing. So for example, I'm going to bump the size because we are doing a phone application here. Okay, and let's make that whatever. And if I run my app into the emulator, it's going to work the same in the phone, or at least so they say. I don't have a phone yet, by the way. If anybody has one, talk to me. And here I see that the actual file has been loaded. I do have a touch screen here, so I should be able to scroll up and down like that. Okay? So this is a very super simple sample. And I'm using a way to create design time data which requires quite a lot of manual work. If you have a very complex collection of objects, that's not going to make it, okay? Because you have to create each property manually. Now, if you have a very complex collection, again, I remind you, you can import from XML, or you can even create sample data from a class. Or you can come to my session tomorrow and see another way to do that with an additional layer in code. So now we understand a little bit better what blendability actually means. So what do you do when you don't have that? Well, it kind of sucks, because you don't see anything, right? So you have to really climb into the XAML a lot more. You have to edit the XAML code manually. Also, you will need a lot more runtime testing. So you need to edit your XAML, run the application, navigate until the dialogs that you are editing, which is very often very far in the application, measure, okay, see if the margins are okay, and then you start again, all right? It's not the nicest job in the world, but it's something that we do often, because very often an application is not 100% blendable, okay? What do you do if you cannot edit your application in Blend, or at least not edit part of the application in Blend? Well, a good strategy is to isolate the issue. So if you have to design a template for a control, and the page in which the control is placed is not blendable, what you can do is have another instance of Blend open, edit your template, and then copy the XAML back into the original application. That's something that we do a lot. I most of the time have multiple instances of Blend open. I have the real stuff, and then I also have things where I try and experiment and do my design. Okay, so another thing I want to talk to you about is tools, because when we do integration, we work with a lot of external tools, third-party or made by Microsoft, depending, and I never really quite saw a collection of tools for integration, so I want to try to give that to you. So one thing which is very important when you do integration is really importing XAML code. And in Expression Blend, you can actually import directly from Photoshop and Illustrator. We will see an example of that in just a moment. Another thing you can do, if you are using Fireworks, which is an Adobe product, there is a tool by Grant Hinkson, who is now working for Microsoft, but he used to be working for another firm when he did that. And let me see. Just going to open Fireworks to show that to you. And this tool has to be installed in addition to Fireworks. And then it comes as a new window, okay, a new panel. And what you can do in that is select objects and then export them to XAML. So what you get when you install that is a new menu item called XAML Suite. And then there is a Firework to XAML. If you start that, this is what you get. So here you can do quite a lot of settings. There are a few settings which are really nice here, actually nicer than what you can do when you import from Photoshop directly into Blend. So I wanted to show that to you, that you know that it exists. Okay. One thing you can do is convert text to parse, which is very useful in some occasion. Normally, you don't want to do that, because normally you want the text to be saved in XAML as an actual text block, which is a default behavior. But sometimes if you have a logo that you want to export, then you don't want this logo. This logo, the text is not editable, and it has to look exactly like the designer made it. Okay? So then you want to check this checkbox, and then the text is going to be converted into a parse. You cannot change the text anymore, but you have high fidelity. You can choose to export the current selection or the whole page. You can save to XAML file, or you can actually copy to the clipboard, which is super useful when you work with Blend Open, because you can just open in split mode, copy your XAML from Fireworks, and paste it directly into Blend. Other options which are really good are the ability to convert rectangles to borders. Because very often, the designer is working with a lot of rectangles on top of each other. And then when you convert that to XAML, one part of your role as an integrator is to simplify the XAML while keeping an acceptable fidelity to the design. You want to simplify the XAML because XAML is code. It's going to be executed. If you want high performance, it's easier if you have less XAML code. So by doing that, you actually do automatically something that we do very often manually, which is instead of a rectangle, I'm going to take a border. Like this, I can also round the corner, et cetera, et cetera. You can trim the decimal precision. This is going to reduce the size of your XAML, because if you have a width which is, you know, 120 pixel 0.12345, it doesn't make sense. So here you can choose how many pixel, how many digits you want. And the last thing which is really good is exporting fields as resources. So the field is the content, the brush, which is filling, for example, a rectangle or a path. And then you can have them automatically exported to resources, because this is also something that we do quite often anyway in Blend, which is taking the object and then saving the field as a local resource. So that's a very useful tool. Then another thing you can do if you are so inclined is export from Expression Design, which is the design tool that Microsoft is making. Now, I have to be very honest with you. I don't know many designers who use Expression Design, but I do know some. So in case you are facing this situation, it's actually possible from Expression Design to export directly to XAML. Okay, another category of tools, previewing what you are doing. One thing is CalcXAML, which is a tool made by Robin Ingebretson. And this is something like Notepad for XAML. So for example, if I go here and I type background, you see that you have IntelliSense, which is pretty cool. I can set the background to red, and my background turns to red. Now you can do stuff even more interesting. Like for example, you have snippets. And for example, I'm going to take this brush here. First of all, let me add grid.background. Here we go. And then I can, for example, take this brush. And then we see that it's actually changing. Now, since it's, you know, XAML, I can actually edit that. So the first one is the black one. So I'm going to set that to red. This one to yellow. And here we go. And then another snippet, which is nice, is a 3D XAML logo. So I can put that into my grid. And now I have a nice logo in three dimension. So it's quite simple to use, but it allows you, when you have something who is not quite sure how the XAML works for a particular item, you can try it very fast. Okay. XAML has other features, so I encourage you to check it out. And all those tools are free, by the way. Another preview tool which is very useful is Shazam. Shazam is a tool which is useful when you work with pixel shaders. So pixel shaders are a very small code file which is acting on every pixel of your application, of your visual. Okay? For example, we all know the drop shadow. When you set a drop shadow, it's actually taking the visual and modifying the pixel so that it casts a shadow on the rest of the UI. But shaders, you have so many of them, and some have, you know, things that you need to parameter. So here you can test that. For example, I'm taking this picture here, and I'm going to take the monochrome shader, and now we see that the picture was modified. You can also check how it works on video. Here we go. And you can even import your own image or some UI if you want. Now, you can also change the parameters, which is very useful if you want to understand how a particular shader is working. For example, here I can set the color. So now if I change to red, we see what happens. Okay. Now, this is here the actual shader file that you will download from internet, for example. But then you need something which is generated C-sharp code, so that, or VB.NET, okay, sorry, that you can import into your actual WPF or SilverLight application. And this is what you can preview here. So Shazam is actually compiling the shader for you in C-sharp. Okay? So that's a great tool. It's free. So, you know, we would be crazy not to use free tools, right? Okay, another thing which is very useful is inspecting your WPF code or your SilverLight code so that you understand what is happening in a running application. So one tool is called Snoop. Again, it's a free tool. It's actually made by Pete Blois, who is working on the Expression Blend team. So let's take here. I made a very complicated application, which is saying, hi, Belgium, hello, actually. And I can toggle it. So that's a WPF application. Now I can start Snoop. Here we go. And there are multiple versions of Snoop, so be sure to choose the correct one. Okay? In that case, my WPF app is a 32-bit application, WPF4. And then I'm going to attach Snoop to the application. Here we go. So now one thing I can do is identify, for example, what is this line here? How is it rendered in my tree? So I press Ctrl-Shift, and then I pass my mouse over the element, and now I lost it, never mind. So here we see that we have a grid, okay, which is a red visual. We have a toggle button, which has a chrome, that's actually the default style for a WPF control. And then there is a content presenter, which renders your text through a text block. So this is everything that WPF does when you just set content equals toggle button. So understanding the tree is quite useful and very important. Another thing you can do is that since you're attached to the actual WPF application, I can go ahead and select the background property, for example, and I can set it to red. And I should be able to set it to red. Here we go. So now I set the background property of my text block to red. So I'm actually modifying a running WPF application, which can be super useful because when you do this edit, run, test, repeat, okay, sometimes you want to see what happens if I change the margins of my element just a little bit. And then you see how the rest of the UI is reacting. Also, you can preview the events which are happening. For example, if I click here, we see that those guys happened. There was a preview mouse down, and then after that there was a mouse down, and it was handled by the toggle button. So that's very useful when you are trying to find out why is my element not reacting to a click. Now, you know, this application is fun, but it's not really, it's nothing spectacular. So instead, do you guys know that Blend is actually a WPF application? So let's see what I can do here. This is called SilverLight application 1, and I'm going to attach Snoop. Here we go. Then I'm able to identify, for example, this panel. Let's see what it is. That's actually a scroll viewer. Okay. So now what I can do is go ahead and change the background color, and let's set it to green. Oops. Here we go. So I'm changing Blend, because Blend is a WPF app. Okay. Also, another thing you can do is the so-called zoomer. So I'm going to magnify my application, and I can actually magnify it in 3D. And I'm going to try to show you how I can actually rotate it. Okay. So now we see every piece of the UI, how it has been stacked. Okay. So that helps you to understand, for example, first of all, the complexity of an application. It also helps us to see, let me see. Yeah, I'm not sure how, here we go. All right, so here I zoom very much on the visuals, and you see that they are actually bitmaps. They are not XAML. Okay, you see that they are pixelized. So that's a sign that it's not XAML, it's actually bitmaps. Now, that was, I'm going to tell you a secret, okay, don't repeat it. That was actually a major performance improvement between Blend 1, I believe, and Blend 2. They replaced all those small icons from XAML to bitmaps, and then the rendering path is much faster. So you can Snoop your app and find out stuff like that. So Snoop is a must-have when you work with WPF. But what happens with Silverlight? When, you know, thankfully, there are people in the community who do great stuff. It's called Silverlight Spy. And Silverlight Spy is actually not free, but it's really loaded with features. So, you know, it's a really nice app. So if I go here and run this application, I need to run it because I need to have a web server, you know, starting up. So that's the integrated web server. I'm going to copy this URL. Those are my daughters, by the way. I always try to mention them at conferences, because after that, when I go back home, I get scolded if I don't. So, all right. So Silverlight Spy, I paste the URL, and then I load the page into Silverlight Spy. Here we go. And now we have multiple things that we can do. First thing is we can inspect the content of the XAP file. For example, if you have an image missing, it's actually pretty good because you can see, you see that's the image here that I have. It's loaded as a resource, as a content, sorry. So it's inside the XAP, inside the zip file. So that's very useful. Another thing which is cool is the object browser. And if you have Reflector installed, you can actually go ahead and select, for example, the main page and see the code. So this feature here is available only if you have Reflector installed already. Everything is intermediate language. Silverlight is just like any other .NET app. Okay, and there is a decompilation, well, immediate languaging Asian or whatever, to show you the code. Isolated storage is pretty useful because you can see what your application is storing locally if that's an out-of-the-browser application. That can be useful. Sometimes the file is missing, you're not sure why. Well, you can go ahead and inspect that. You can see the styles that are used in your application. So that's just a bunch of XAML code. For example, this radio button is using this style. That's the default style of the Silverlight app. And you can do pretty much the same that I did before with Snoop, which is isolate parts of the UI and inspect them to see, you know, how are they actually rendered. So this text block was actually never put by me into the button. Okay? It was rendered by Silverlight. I just put content equals button, and the rest is done by Silverlight. It's expanding the tree. So that's a very useful tool to debug your visuals. Okay, so we have inspecting. Now let's talk about measuring. Now that's something that we do a lot. So here is another tool by Pete Blois, who is a guy who did the Snoop application. It's called Ruler, and it's very useful when you need to measure anything on your screen. This is actually a WPF app. For example, I can take here, and I'm going to measure the boundaries of this star. It's 18 by 18. Okay, that's super useful when you have an Adobe Photoshop file. You don't want to export everything. You just want to measure how big is it. You're not quite sure how to do it. Or you have an application running in WPF that you need to translate to Silverlight. That was my last project. And then, you know, the margins are not exactly the same. You need to know. For margins, you can use this guy here. And I'm going to measure the margin between, you know, the border of my screen and this black frame here. 61 pixels, very useful. Well, you know, that's what it does. It's a measuring tool. Another measuring tool which is useful, calipers. Now, you have multiple ones. I'm using one that I like, and I've been using it for years, so I continue to do so. It's actually very simple. You can just start the calipers, and then you can go ahead, move with the arrows, and then use the minus to resize. Here we go. And now I see that this using statement is using exactly 33 pixels of screen. Okay? So that's very convenient. You can actually rotate them and see also vertically. Okay. Now this is an old one. It works well enough, so I'm continuing to use them. You have quite a lot of calipers tool available, so that's something that I would encourage you to download if you do any integration work. Oops. And then finally, there is a question of cleaning up. Okay. When you do a complex application, very often you end up having a lot of resources that you actually don't use in your app. And it's, you know, in Silverlight especially, it's worth removing them because all those resources are going to be parsed when your application starts. So it's going to take some time. So I cannot show you the tool to do that here because unfortunately I have a 64-bit virtual machine and I noticed at the last moment that Pistachio doesn't run on 64-bit. But I took some screenshots, so it's the next best thing. And, you know, I kind of bugging Grant. Grant is the guy who did the fireworks export panel, so I'm bugging him a lot to make a new version with additional features and also to have a 64 version. So this is a tool. You can load a csproj file, and then it's inspecting your whole XAML. Here, this is in Blend, the view where I see that this orange resource is used in two places. And then if I remove the object that use the orange brush, then if I run Pistachio, I see here that I have 8 resources, but out of those 8, only 7 are used. So I have one which is unused. And then I can see, you see there is a small green square, and here in that case it's white. It means this resource is not used, while the other one is used into the file mainpage.xaml at line 26. That's all the tool does. Okay, but it does it pretty well. Now again, I hope that we will see a new version, so with additional features. Now if I want to remove that brush too, right now I have to go into Visual Studio or Blend and delete it manually. Okay. All right, so we talked about tools. Now I'm going to show you basically what I do every day in my work. So I'm going to take some assets and import them into a Silverlight application, so that we see, you know, tips and tricks how to work. So the first thing I want to try is to take this fireworks file. Oops, here we go. You know what? Let me do something else. I'm rather going to go down, and I'm going to zoom using fireworks directly. Here we go. So this slider is actually something we did use in an actual application. Okay, the other example I'm going to show you is also something that we actually use in an application. So these gestures that I'm going to show you are stuff that I did in the real life app. Okay, now this is a slider, and you see my designer was actually very good because he gave me the 4 states of the slider, because very often the designer forgets that, so they give you only the normal default state. Here I have up, which is normal. I have over, which is a mouse over. I have the down state, which is the pressed state. And I have the disabled state. Okay? So if the designers don't give you that, you need to ask them to give you that, because your role as an integrator is not to invent the design. Okay? That's the role of the designer. So now how can I import that? Well, the first thing we need to know is how does actually a slider work. So again, you know, WPF and Silverlight knowledge, you need to understand that. Now, this is how a default slider works in Silverlight. You have a place here where you can click, and it's going to decrease the value. Have another place here where you can click, and it's going to increase the value. And then you have a stuff, you know, a small widget that you can drag. Now, in terms of controls, this is actually a repeat button. This is called a thumb, and this is another repeat button. Now, those repeat buttons, the red guy and the yellow guy, they are actually invisible. You don't see them. But they are here. If you click, something happens. So that's a template. So we need to reproduce that. And Silverlight uses something which is called the states and part model. So let's go into msdn.com, and I'm going to check the slider class, which is a control class. And here you have actually a definition of what the template expects. So we see that there are 2 templates that you must do. There is one which is vertical, and then the other one is horizontal. And this is normal because the slider has an orientation property. So you have 2 parts two big templates inside one. Okay? Now we see that the horizontal template should be a framework element, so basically it can be pretty much anything you want. And then there is the horizontal track large change increase repeat button, and the same for decrease, and those guys are a repeat button. And the reason why is because the behavior when you press and hold on the slider is that the value is going to increase or decrease continuously. So you need a repeat button to do that. So now we know exactly what we need to build the slider. So let's do it. So here I am in Expression Blend. That's a Silverlight app. And the first thing I want to know is approximately how big is this thing. So now I'm zoomed at 200%. I'm going to change my calipers. It doesn't mean that this slider will always be the same size, but it's going to help me when I do my design to make sure that it looks exactly the same. Here we go. It's 380, more or less. So it's more or less at 200% zoom, okay, so it's more or less 190 pixels wide. So I'm going to do the same here into Blend. Again, it's only so that I have a reference. So I create here a grid. I set the width to 190 pixels, and then I need to know the height. Now, the height is going to be given by this sum element, and it's 42 times 42, 200% zoom, so it's 21 pixels times 21. So here, I'm also going to set the height of the grid to 21 pixels. Now, the next thing I will do is put a place where I can put this slider, okay? So I'm going to make a cell in my app, in my grid. I'm going to select it and set it to 21 pixels. Now, remember I said we have repeat buttons here. So let's add them. I'm going to go to the assets library, take a repeat button, and I need two of them. The first one is going to be in the first cell, and the last one is going to be, obviously, in the last colon. Why is it not doing it? Reset. Okay. Now I need to reset those margins. Here we go. Oops, it didn't do it. Reset. Okay. So now I have my two repeat buttons. Now those guys are actually invisible. So I'm going to set the opacity to 0%. I cannot collapse them because or else they wouldn't react to the click. So I just set them transparent. And then just to give a visual indication to the user, personally I like to have the cursor change to a hand when there is something that you can click. It's just a visual cue for the user. Okay, then let's see what we have. We have this bar here, which is below. Let's take a look how it actually looks like. We see that it's actually a 2 pixel high bar with two different colors. Now, in Silverlight, this screams for a border, because border, you can set the width of a border only on one side if you want. So you can easily do a two-color separation, okay? Let me show you how to do that. I'm going to select here a border. I'm going to make it take the whole space. So the column span should be 3. It's extending over my whole slider. Now, I said that I want to have two colors. So I'm going to set the background color and the border brush color to different brushes. Okay? So I'm going to say I don't want a border on the side. I don't want a border on the right side. I want 1 pixel on top and 0 pixel in the bottom. And then it should be exactly 2 pixels high. Now let's go and see what we have. Here we go. Now I'm going to go ahead and copy those colors. Now Blend has a super feature, which is that when you take a brush, you can take the color, the eyedropper, and you can actually copy colors from outside the application. That's really very, very useful. So here I copy the top one, and now the background, which is the bottom one in my bar, I'm going to go and copy the bottom one. Here we go. All right. Now the last thing that we see, if we observe the models that the designer did, Where is my fireworks? Here we go. Is that I have a gradient in the end, and then it's blending with the background, okay? And I'm going to check approximately how big is that, just that I have an ID. It's approximately until here, so it's 90 pixels. I zoom 600%. That's something that you do a lot, so usually I have a calculator next to my table. So it's about, well, 50 divided by 3, let's say 15 pixels, maybe 18 pixels wide, okay? So what I'm going to do here to solve this issue is going to use a so-called opacity mask. So I'm going to change the opacity of my visual as it is running with a gradient. So I have a property like that in XAML. I'm going to take a linear gradient brush. I'm going to set gradients. By default, it is vertical. I want it to be actually horizontal. Or what you can do, you can actually change the values here. So I want it to go from 0, 0, which is the top right corner, to 1, 0, which is actually top left corner, and then the other one is the top right corner. Sorry. Okay. Now I need to do the gradient. So the way that opacity mask is working is that it's only considering the alpha blending of your color. So it's totally ignoring the color itself. It's only taking the opacity of the color. So I will place some gradients. And then this one, I set it completely transparent. This one is 100%, 100%, and then again, 0. And now I just have to measure what I did before. I said 18 pixels, more or less. But actually what you can do is, since here I'm zoomed at, 600%, I measured. What I can do very easily is go here at 600%. Here we go. And then I'm going to measure again. Here we go. And I'm just going to move this gradient here. And let's do that on the other side also. Here we go. I can see actually the first gradient is at 8.9%, so the next one should be at 91.1%. Where is it? Here. Here. 91.9. Here we go. So now I have my gradient. I'm going to put this guy, the border, totally in the background because my buttons are invisible anyway, so they can be on top. Okay, like this, it doesn't block any click. Now, I still need to work on this bullet here. Here it is. So this is an ellipse, so I'm just going to take an ellipse and put it here. Oops, and I have a small issue here. Sorry, I don't want to put it into the border. Let me just do like that. I'm going to put it in the column number 1. With 0 pixels margin, all right? And then I need to check the color of those guys. So I'm going to zoom. Oops, where did it go? Yeah, that's a small bug in Blend. Sometimes it actually resets the property to the previous value. I already said that to the team. But okay. So now I'm going to do some measuring of colors. Again, we saw how to do that before. But actually, you see, that's actually a gradient that I have here. So I need to take the stroke and also make it. Now you understand why when you work with Blend, you need 2 or 3 monitors, okay, and a bigger resolution than that. So I'm going to take the stroke, change that to a gradient. The gradient by default is vertical. I want it to be horizontal. Here we go. And then this one here, I can measure that. Next one, I'm going to measure here, okay? And then for the fill, you can take the fill, also set it to a gradient, turn it in the right direction, and then you can also measure gradients by taking this, holding and pressing your button, and selecting the whole gradient. So now I have the exact same gradient that I used to have. Okay? So now I have all the elements that I need to make my control. So in Blend, I can choose the grid, which is the the container of the control. I go in edit, object. I need to right-click and make into control. Here we go. And now I can choose which control I want to create. It's a slider in that case. So what's going to happen is that Blend is creating a style with a template, and it's going to apply it to a new control that it's placing in your UI. So that's just a shortcut. Now I'm inside the slider template, OK? Before, I just had a grid with a bunch of visuals, but now those visuals have actually a meaning. So I need to tell how to identify that. The grid, I'm going to make it into a part of the slider, which is the horizontal template. Then notice that there is a small piece of puzzle here. You see, it means it actually has a meaning. Then the first repeat button is going to be the horizontal large change. Who remembers the whole name? Yeah, me neither. So horizontal track large change decrease repeat button. Boom. Next one, increase. And then for the ellipse, I'm going to do the thumb, horizontal thumb, which actually creates me yet an additional style and yet an additional template. So now my focus is on the template of this thumb control. All right. You see that it moved, by the way, because now it's a slider. The value of the slider is 0, which means automatically it should be on the left-hand side, on the far left. Okay. So now I'm going to create state for this guy. So I can change to the state panel. And I see that I have normal, mouse over, pressed, and disabled. I'm just going to ignore that. So let's see what my designer did. Well, first of all, he said, OK, this brush, the border brush, should be different when it's hovered and pressed. So I'm going to take two other ellipses, going to name it hover and pressed. Now here, I could actually go ahead and change the colors, do some color animation. But it's actually very complex to do, and it's also very difficult to change when the designer changed their mind later. So I would recommend rather working with opacities on different elements. And then when you see that the designer says, OK, now it's OK, and when you see that your application maybe has some performance issues, then you can go ahead and simplify the XAML. Okay? It's going to make your life a little bit easier. So now if I take the hover one, let's go ahead and measure this visual here. So I'm going to take the stroke, the first one, which is on the left, measure. This one on the right, measure. Now I want to reuse that for the pressed one, so I'm going to export that as a resource. All right. And then in the case of the pressed bullet, for the stroke, I'm going to reuse this resource. And for the fill, I'm going to measure this one. Here we go. And now, finally, the last thing I need to do is what is displayed in which state. So in the default state, both of them have to be to 0%. I just have the default ellipse. In the hover state, in the mouse over state, I'm going to show the hover ellipse. And then in the pressed state, I'm going to show the pressed ellipse. I'm going to do that a little bit smoother for normal to mouse over. I'm going to say you have to use 300 milliseconds, because it's a little bit smoother, it's a small animation. For mouse over to normal, I'm going to also do the same, 300. And now if you wanted, you could even change the acceleration of the animation. Okay, you can choose all that. So for example, you can do a bounce if you want to have a ball with an effect. In this case, you know, let's just do something a little bit fast and then a little bit slow, for example, a circle like that. OK, so now my slider is finished. Now, since I did a style and a template, it means that all the sliders in my application can reuse this style and template. So this is typically a job that you do once in your application. OK? So now let's use this one. So to use it, I can, for example, take a text block, and I'm simply going to bind this text block to my slider, to the value property. Here we go. OK, we see that now we have 0. Let's bump the size a little bit to make it easier to see. And now if I run my app, I actually have a functioning slider in my application, and it looks exactly like what the designer gave me. OK? So that's a process. OK? It actually takes a little bit longer now because I'm explaining the steps. But still, it shows that by exporting, measuring, by using the tools that you have at your disposal, you can do this kind of process, you know, in a very high fidelity way. Now, the other thing I wanted to show you, it's actually this time from Photoshop. So this is also a visual that we use in an actual application. And it's a dialog box that you can display. Oops, okay. That you can display when you want to show something. Okay. So now in Photoshop you have layers. So as I said, the nice thing that you should do if you do integration is be able to navigate the layers and identify which object is doing what. For example, this guy here is the button down there. Okay. So I can hide it and show it. When you work with designers, it's actually very good. You have to educate them and show them that they should structure their design meaningfully. Because it's not just a comp anymore. It's not just a picture anymore. It's actually an asset that you're going to use in your application. Okay? So ask them to structure the layers meaningfully, meaning, for example, if you have a control like a button, they should make a separate layer for this button so that you can export it easily. Okay? Also, it helps if they use meaningful names for those layers, because like this you can find it more easily, you know, which one you want to remove, which one you want to show. So that's my visual. Okay, it has a drop shadow. It actually has a drop shadow and also a gradient overlay. So now I'm removing the shadow just that we see the difference. If I remove the gradient overlay, I'm not sure. Yeah, on this screen, we don't really see it so well, but there is a difference in the gradient, okay? Now, the designers did that as an overlay, which is actually a little bit complicated to do in Blend. You can do it, but I'm going to show you a simpler way to do that. So first thing I will do is import this file into Expression Blend. So I can go choose File, and then here, remember I just told you, import Adobe Illustrator or import Adobe Photoshop. Choosing this one. And then you have a last chance to select which layers you actually want to show. Now, this is very convenient because you don't need Photoshop installed to do that. You can do that directly from Blend. Another thing which is very convenient, I don't know if you know that, but the PSD file, if you don't have Photoshop installed, Windows 7 is able to open them as a picture in the Windows Photo Viewer. So you can just double-click your PSD. Maybe I can even show that. Yeah. Okay, in that case, yeah, I'm not sure why not. Normally, you can open that and see it as a picture. Maybe it's because Photoshop is actually installed. PNGs, which is the format that Adobe Illustrator, Adobe Fireworks is using, the same. You can open it. It has layers. So, you know, from the point of view of Adobe Fireworks, it's actually a complex file. But you will see the composition if you open it if you don't have Fireworks installed. So you don't need those tools installed. So now I have here my dialog where I can choose my elements. And in this case, what I want to remove is the wallpaper. I don't need it. I just want it to be transparent. I'm going to import that. And let's take a look at what it did. You see there is a small different, yeah, it's very subtle, but there is a small different color here. So this one is actually a triangle. And in the import process, the overlay was lost. Blend is not able to import the overlay. So we are going to have to change that. Now, on the other hand, Blend was able to import the shadow. Okay? And we can actually see that the shadow is here. It's a pixel shader, just like I showed you before in Shazam. All the parameters have actually been exported as well. However, it has been applied only to this shape, which is a rectangular shape, and not to the whole thing. So I'm going to take it by cutting it away from my tree. Now it's in memory. Select those two shapes and combine them into one with a unite operation. So now I have only one shape. And then I'm going to paste the shadow effect on this new shape. And now you see that the shape is actually applied to the small to this small triangle down there. So that's the first step. Then let's move this outside of the canvas in which it has been imported. So I'm just going to cut it and paste it in the layout route, which is my main grid. And I can discard those canvas. I don't need them anymore. Now I want to show this dialog when something happens. So that screams for a pop-up. Let's go ahead and take a pop-up. Here we go. So I have my pop-up here with a grid. And this grid is not transparent. I want it to be transparent because I don't want it to be visible. I just want my path to be visible. And now I can take the path and paste it into my pop-up. So now if I click somewhere else, the pop-up is closed. If I click on the pop-up, Blend expands them so that you can design them. Now we can use the pop-up. For example, let's take a checkbox. Oops. Oh, this is not what I want to do. I want the checkbox to be here inside my main grid. To move it down there. And then I'm going to bind the isOpen property to the isChecked property of my checkbox. Finally, now you see the pop-up because I'm selecting it in the tree view, in the view, in the object viewer here. What I can do now is move it so that it appears a little bit nicer. So I'm going to increase the horizontal offset and also the vertical offset. Here we go. And now I can run my app. And in about, 5 minutes, I just made a pretty stylish dialog box for my application. OK? So when do you import and when do you measure? Typically, I would say the import process from Photoshop, Fireworks, so the import to XAML works well when you want to have a path, and then you want to reproduce that path as a vector in XAML. That's what I just did. For brushes, personally, I don't really trust the export mechanism so well. I think the eyedropper is actually more truthful to the actual brush. So I prefer to use the eyedropper. You can export fields as well. We actually saw that. But I would be careful with that. One thing I forgot how to show is this overlay, this gradient overlay, which is especially difficult to do. Let's go in Photoshop here. Okay. So you remember if I remove the overlay, now I have a standard color, a solid color, but here I have a brush which is applied on top. Now in Silverlight, if I wanted to do that, what I would have to do is copy the path, paste it on top in the grid, make it transparent, and then play with a linear gradient brush to make it look exactly like I want. But this is very difficult because you cannot measure transparency. So instead, in a spirit of simplification, what we can do is simply change the background color of this path by measuring the one that I have in Photoshop. Now, obviously, this is a design decision that I'm taking here. Okay, I'm changing that to look like this. In my personal opinion, it's good enough as an integrator. But in the opinion of the designer, you should review that with him, because in the end, it's his design. So you do a review process with him to make sure that he's happy with the result. All right? OK, so More information about integrators in general, Nathan Dunlop is my boss at IdentityMind. Robin Ingebretsen used to work for IdentityMind. Now he's working as an independent designer and developer. Now those two guys basically invented the role. So if you want more info, go and check their blogs and go and check their work in general. They are, you know, the bearers of knowledge. My own blog, very humbly, don't feel free to follow me if you like. And if you want to continue the conversation, I'm very happy to get you all on Twitter. Last year I asked, who knows Twitter? Nobody raised hand. Who knows Twitter? Yeah, that's better. Okay, you guys are moving in the right direction. So follow me and we can continue the discussion. I do have 5 minutes if you have questions. So feel free to shout the question. I will repeat it. Yeah, in a true Belgian tradition. I see a question. To the slider, right. So the question is, how did I convert those elements that I had? I had a grid, buttons, and an ellipse into a slider. So the answer is, if you right-click, let me see if I can go back in time. Template, see a little bit more. Okay, so here I am exactly where I was at this moment. Okay, I have my grid, border, which is the line, and then I have repeat button, and the ellipse. Now I can select the container, and then I can right-click and choose Make into Control. This is a feature that was added in Expression Blend 3, so I'm using 4 here, but it was already available in 3. And then I get this dialog where I can select all the built-in controls that I want to template. Now, what it is actually doing is that's just a simplification process for the creation of a template in Blend. Okay? You could go the classic way, which is do a new style, do a new template, start from zero, and then go ahead and place your elements and do everything. This is a simplification. It's especially good for simple controls like buttons, because buttons, typically, you have just an image or a path or whatever. Right-click, make a button, and that's it. Okay, so that's much faster. For a slider, it's a little bit more complex, but this is the way. All right? Yep, absolutely. So what you get, the question is it possible to pack this in a DLL or something? Now, you see what it's doing is actually creating a button style. Well, in that case, a button. If I want to select the slider, here we go. I have a slider style. Now, I can choose to file this style into the application, which would be the app.xaml, into this document, which is a user control, or into, it's grayed out because I don't have one now, but into an external resource dictionary. And this resource dictionary can be saved into a different DLL. Okay? So if you set it up, at first you can do that directly from here. Now, in general, this is not how we work. In general, I create all my templates and style locally at first, and then I move them around using the... Let me just do that. Here I have a resources tab, and this is a slider style that I just created. Now, if I had a resource dictionary in my application... Actually, let's do one. Add new item, and I'm going to choose a resource dictionary. Now, I could put that guy into a separate DLL. I can take my slider style and drag it to another resource dictionary so that you can reuse it everywhere in your app. Okay? Any other question? I don't see any hands, so... Oh, there is one. Snoop XAML. So Snoop is actually working on the running app. Okay? So what you see is what has been parsed, interpreted, and rendered. Snooping XAML, basically that would be something like KXAML, where if you take a snippet of XAML, paste it into KXAML, you will see what is rendered. Or, you know, Blend. XAML is the static thing that you design, and then at runtime it's actually, you know, convert it to something binary, right? Yeah, right. So In WPF, there is nothing that I know of. The problem in WPF, you see, is that most of the time your XAML is actually saved as a binary XML file, which is called BAML, binary application markup language. So this is just bytes. You cannot snoop that. In Silverlight, if you open the Silverlight Spy product that I showed you, you can actually see the XAML that is rendered, that is used by your application. Okay? Because in Silverlight, the XAML file is actually included as content inside the XAP file into the DLL. Okay? You didn't see it? Let me see. If I go to Silverlight Spy, where is it now? I might have closed it. Just come to me, okay, because my time is up. So come to me, I will show you. For the rest of you, thank you very much for your attention, and hopefully I will see you tomorrow at the continuation or the deeper dive into the MVVM pattern. Thank you.